This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dan, first of all, welcome back to the new week, and a lot going on we will be getting into as we continue through the day. In our second hour, Larry Johnson's going to drop by, former CIA officer, State Department officer, counterterrorism expert, talking about the destruction of the torture tapes at the CIA. And we're going to be asking, what is the true nature of America and Americans? Are we a brave people, or are we a nation of terrified little people? And in our third hour, it's International Human Rights Day. Ajamu Baraka is going to drop by with the U.S. Human Rights Network. We'll be talking about that briefly. And throughout the day, I really want to get into some of these economic issues. And we'll begin right there, right now. Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., businessandmedia.org, the website. Dan, welcome to the show.
Merry Christmas. Good to be back.
Well, thank you, Dan, and Merry Christmas to you. And also, I think Hanukkah is still going on right now.
Yeah, happy Hanukkah to everyone.
So happy Hanukkah to all our listeners as well.
And I think every other holiday we'd spend all day naming holidays.
Well, not all day. I mean, there's three or four major ones, but
we're a little early for Kwanzaa, I think.
Yeah, I think we are, and it's not the solstice yet, so
we can't tip
our hat to the animists. Yeah. So anyhow, recession. You're out there saying that ain't nothing to worry about. The economy's doing just fine.
Well, actually, not entirely true, but essentially there's a glass half full and a glass half empty side to it, and you're only seeing the glass half empty if you tune in the major networks. The glass half full, there's a lot of good news out there. And, I mean, you know, just even Friday, we continue to surprise people, have better unemployment numbers, better job numbers than anybody predicts. We're like 51 straight months now of positive job numbers, not stopped by Katrina, not stopped by even the blip we had in September. Turned out it was actually just early reporting. You know, that's a good number. We had the third quarter growth numbers, 4.9% growth. That's strong by anybody's measure. So, yes, there is good news.
If you make your money at the top of the economy, if you're a top feeder rather than a bottom feeder, or a top player rather than a bottom player, I guess would be a better way to say it, then, you know, things are doing quite well. The economy is growing. But here's some statistics. This comes out of the Department of Labor. Okay, it's pretty straightforward stuff. Robert Reich, who used to be the Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, compiled this stuff and shared it on public radio a couple days ago. The income of a young man in his 30s today is 12% below that of the same person, of somebody the same age in the same job 3 decades ago. So the first way that we made up for this is wives went to work, working women. The number of women with school-aged children in the workforce 30 years ago was 38%. Today it's 70%. So then families, you know, that was the first coping mechanism. And that kind of maxed out. And now, then it went to working longer. We now work 2 weeks longer than we did 30 years ago. In fact, we work longer than even the famous workaholic Japanese. And that wasn't enough. And so we went to the third coping mechanism over the last decade, over the last 10 years, and that was using our homes as ATM machines, taking money out of our homes to maintain a middle-class lifestyle. And that's exploding. And so now, here we have middle-class Americans who are still making 12% less than they were 3 decades ago. They're getting wiped out, Dan. They're getting wiped out. I mean, you might not call it an official recession because we haven't had 3 consecutive quarters of negative growth. But I would say over the last 30 years, that, you know, basically ever since Reagan came into office and started inflicting Reaganomics on America, we're seeing the death and destruction of the middle class.
And I wildly disagree. First of all, you referred to women working as a coping mechanism.
Last time I checked, for families.
As I remember, the rise of feminism, women having equal rights in the workplace, women wanted to work. So it's not so much a coping.
There certainly are many women who want to work, and mostly that would be single women. I'm talking about families. I'm talking about women with children.
I'm talking about women with children as well. I know many women with children who maintain both their family lives and a career, and they wanted to do both.
So you're saying that the doubling of the number of women with children in the workplace is purely because they wanted to, not because they had to, not because their families were forcing them to keep. I mean, frankly, if Louise and I were able to make it on one salary and she worked, I'd stay at home with the kids. I mean, actually, there have been times when I did.
And that's great if you choose to do so. I thought the... You know, I thought the left was all. I feel like we've almost flipped the debate around here. You're lobbying against women in the workplace.
I'm lobbying in favor of people being able to raise a family on one paycheck. That was the square deal that Teddy Roosevelt talked about in 1908.
But society has changed. Look at all the things we're buying now that we live as a society with greater wealth than anybody's ever had. We have a lot of things, though.
Not true. We have greater debt than we've ever had.
A lot of things our ancestors never had, we now consider to be not only luxuries but necessities. Cell phones, internet service, DVD players, big screen TVs, multiple cars.
We have stuff. That's not wealth.
But if you want to live without many of those things, as previous generations, as my parents did, as your parents did, if you want to live that way, then you don't need...
No, their quality of life was not substantially different from ours. I mean, what I did as a kid in the 50s and 60s with a telephone, people are doing today with cell phones and the internet. I mean, the fact that technology has changed the nuance of the ways in which we communicate and keep in touch doesn't alter the landscape, and it hasn't significantly increased the costs. No, telephones, I remember when you used to have to save up for a whole week to be able, or at least in my family, we used to have to save up for a whole week to be able to afford the phone call to my grandparents.
Where do they live?
They lived in northern Michigan. I lived in Lansing, Michigan. It was like a $10 or $12 phone call to call them, because back in that day, back in the late 1950s, early 60s, a long-distance call cost a lot of money.
Right, and the key point was we didn't do it. Now there are a lot of things.
No, we did do it. We just saved for it. Just like today, if you want to, you know, it's $70 a month to have a cell phone with unlimited calling,
and
or whatever
you have
it is.
Internet,
you know?
And then you have cable, and then
yeah.
My
point is that it hasn't changed. That we're still communicating with each other. We're still communicating with friends and family. The nature of that may have changed, but the bottom line is that we are poorer. The middle class has been wiped out. Millionaires and billionaires are doing very well. Thank you very much.
The middle class hasn't been wiped out. Some of the measures that we're using to analyze people, for instance, like median income, the whole concept of median income, for one thing, when you study how people in the lower end are earning, the measures tend to downplay government support. Then at the higher end, you know, what we're experiencing is a demographic change. A lot of people have gotten older. So the numbers, you know, people typically have more money when they're later in their life. Because our society has gotten older, that accounts for a lot of the disparity.
If people have more money as they get older, then you should be seeing average income going up, and we're not. We haven't seen average income. People are making about, you know, when you consider all age groups, I mean, these numbers I was giving you were for men in their 30s. When you consider all age groups, we've seen about a 1.5% increase in you know, net take-home pay adjusted for inflation with taxes and everything else between the end of the Carter administration and today.
Well, we keep hearing the cries of, you know, somehow, oh, this split between rich and poor, you know, the great wealth gap. But the reality of the wealth gap is a demographic gap. People early in their lives, and now a lot of them are indebting themselves even further because they're not choosing to go.
So you're saying that during the Eisenhower administration, when you had a top 91% income tax rate for people earning more than $3.2 million in today's dollars, that during that time, when the average income of CEOs in the United States, regardless of company size, was between 30 and 60 times that of the average worker, and today it's between 300 and 500 times that of the average worker, that's simply because CEOs are getting older?
No, it's not just because CEOs are getting older, but it is a factor. If you want to go back to a time, and Americans clearly don't want to go back to this time, you want to go back to a time when government taxation was just almost completely confiscatory.
Most Americans would love to go back to that time because average working people making in the equivalent of $40,000 today, more or less the median income, were paying fewer taxes,
more than that.
Far less taxes under the Eisenhower administration than they are today.
Yeah, median income is much closer, so I think 49. 200 and some.
Okay, so say 50. Nonetheless, the average, when you look at people at median income, the percentage of their taxes that it was actually paid, that average middle class worker was lower under Eisenhower than it is today. There's been a huge shift of taxes to the middle class. Reagan doubled the Social Security, the FICA tax on the, and it only hit at that time people making $40,000 a year and less. Now it's $90,000 a year and less.
Hey, if you want to go after taxes, I'm all with you.
I'm saying, you know, tax the rich. Let's tax the corporations. They used to pay half the tax load. Now they pay 7%.
Let's have a nice fair or flat tax that helps everybody.
Well, fair, yes. Flat. Okay, we'll continue this conversation one of these days. Dan Gaynor. Yeah, Dan with the businessandmedia.org is the website, the Business and Media Institute. Thanks, Dan.
Again, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. 16 minutes.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ain't no surplus now, it's gone. Oh, the debt grows every day. Yes, the balance of our loans is bigger than Star Jones. Tell the kids they'll have to pay. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I wish this debt would go away. I could try to pay these bills, or sell Dick Cheney's pills, or put Congress on eBay.
I actually want to sell Limbaugh's pills. I think that's the... Yeah, we owe, we owe, we owe. By the way, the Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 21 minutes past the hour. Just check out some of these headlines. Today's Wall Street Journal. U.S. mortgage crisis rivals SNL meltdown. Toll of economic shock may linger for years. A global credit crunch. That's the headline. The story gets worse. Here's another one from the Wall Street Journal. This is a more of an op-ed piece by Timothy Apple, The Outlook. The headline, profit slump deepens recession worries. U.S. corporate profits are being hammered by the slowing economy and credit market turmoil, intensifying concerns that the nation may be headed for recession. Businesses ranging from makers of artificial hips to surfwear retailers to overnight delivery services are also feeling the pinch. FedEx, for example, said the weakening economy and cutbacks in consumer spending were making for a weaker-than-expected holiday shipping season. Meanwhile, more companies are warning investors of dark clouds ahead, and they note Zimmer Holdings, Pitney Bowes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No Post Group of France. I mean, this is a Volcom of California. In the midst of this, our good friends in Iran say, nah, we ain't taking no more dollars. They have completely halted all oil transactions in dollars. Now, as I recall, Saddam Hussein did the same thing about, what, a month, 2 months before Bush started bombing him? Or if he didn't do it, he threatened to do it? Meanwhile, as Citicorp was about to go down the tube, you know, I believe it's the largest bank of the United States, now one of the largest European banks, UBS, they're writing down $10 billion. Why? Because of the U.S. subprime crisis. So Citicorp, the American bank, got bailed out by somewhere between $8 and $11 billion from Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, from a sovereign wealth fund from the Middle East. And now now UBS, the European bank, the Swiss bank, is the fourth largest in Europe. They're getting $10 billion from Singapore and from the Middle East. Are you starting to see a pattern here? It's like American banks, American companies, European banks, European companies owned by Middle Eastern and Chinese interests, or an Asian interest. Singapore is not China, but an Asian interests. Could it have something to do with the insane policies that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan began inflicting upon Brits and the U.S. and that have been followed in lockstep by conservatives in the U.K. for the last 30 years? I think so. And in fact, as the BBC reported, this was a couple of years ago, but actually, there's a recent one. This just came out in the British Journal of Psychiatry. They were looking at suicides in Hong Kong, and they noted that from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, property values went up 600%. The stock market soared 400%. They had a bubble. And then in 97, when China took over, the bubble burst. And between 98 and 2000, more and more Hong Kong residents killed themselves. And they were looking at the difference in ways that people were killing themselves rather than quantifying it. But this earlier study done in the United Kingdom actually quantified it. And they, and here I'm quoting from the BBC. BBC News. The headline, more suicides under conservative rule. It's a picture of Maggie Thatcher, and the head and the slug underneath the caption underneath the photograph says the suicide rate increased under Margaret Thatcher. Here's the article. The suicide rate increases under conservative government, research suggests. Australian scientists found the suicide rate in the country increased significantly when a conservative government was in power, and an analysis of figures in the UK seems to suggest a similar trend. They looked in New South Wales between 1901 and when the federal government was established in Australia, New South Wales, the region where Sydney is, and 1998. The researchers took into account periods of drought in World War II. Adjusted for these factors, the figures clearly showed the highest rates of suicide occurred when conservatives were in power both at the state and federal level. Conversely, the lowest suicide rates occurred when state and federal governments were both Labor. That would be the Liberals. When conservatives ruled, I'm quoting now from the BBC, when conservatives ruled both state and federal governments, men were 17% more likely to commit suicide than when Labor was in power. Women were 40% more likely to kill themselves. This was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. Overall, they say, again, I'm quoting from the BBC, overall, they say, the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the conservatives not been in power. End of quote. So there you go. Meanwhile, in the Financial Times today, U.S. and EU drop fire over call to drop tariffs. We're trying to tell the Africans, you've got to stop protecting your solar industries, your ethanol industries, your biofuel industries, so that we can sell to you without restriction. They're saying, hey, wait a minute, we want to protect these industries until they get on their feet. The Chinese are saying to them, that's fine, we'll support you in maintaining tariffs, which is what we should have done all along. We got wiped out by them. Europe's getting wiped out by them. Now the World Bank, the One World guys, they want Africa to... And Africans are saying, no, sorry, we're not going to have this. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Just to quickly summarize this, then we'll pick up your phone calls here. Two articles out of today's Financial Times that are really very much worth reading, particularly once you understand the backstory. The first is titled, U.S. and EU Draw Fire Over Call to Drop Tariffs. The other is Africa Warns of Rupture Over European Tariffs. And they both have to do the same thing. Here's how tariffs work. For 200 years in the United States, so much so that tariffs represented 100% of the income of the federal government up until the time of the Civil War, a third of the income of the federal government up until the time of World War One, two-thirds of the income, a third of the federal government's income up until World War II, and now it's about 2%. So, you know, of all things. But this was a huge and substantial thing. We said, if you're going to make... And the modern version of this would be like solar panels, for example. If you're going to make solar panels in Malaysia or something like that, then Chris, I got to tell you, I'm hearing some audio of myself, but it's not me speaking right now coming back to me from you, and it's very faint. I don't know what you can do about that. Thank you. If you're going to make, we'll use the example of shoes. If you're going to make a pair of shoes here, and it costs a dollar per pair for the labor, and you want to make that same pair of shoes in China, where it costs 10 cents for the labor, or in Mexico, where it costs 20 cents for the labor, then when you import, that's fine, we can't stop you from doing that, but when you import those shoes into the United States, there's going to be a 90-cent tariff coming from China, an 80-cent tariff coming from Mexico, so that the cost to make shoes is a dollar no matter where you make them. And the countries of Africa want to do the same thing with regard to renewable energy. They want to say, okay, if we're going to manufacture biofuels here, then and you want us to import your biofuels, or if we're going to manufacture solar panels here and you want us to import your solar panels, we're going to put on an import tariff so that our local domestic industries will have a chance to grow. And here the first the U.S. and EU draw fire over call to drop tariffs. This piece by Fiona Harvey and John Agliabni in Bali. Proposals by rich nations that poor countries should remove their trade barriers on environmental goods to combat global warming yesterday raised a storm at the U.N. climate change talks in Bali. U.S. and European Union found a rare common cause when they combined to ask developing nations to cut or remove tariffs on imports of environmental goods and services. Poor countries pointed out that the U.S. and EU retain import tariffs on biofuels. So we're protecting our biofuel industries, but we're saying to them, you got to drop the protections on yours. Other developing countries were also understood to be concerned that the proposal would only benefit rich nations by opening up export markets in green goods and services before poor countries had a chance to develop them. That's what it's all about. In this other article, Africa warns of rupture over European tariffs. Some African countries, led by South Africa, continue to stall on signing the economic partnership agreements that would lower tariffs, threatening a year-end deadline. Abdoulaye Wade, Senegal's president, says the economic partnership agreements would, quote, amputate state budgets and ruin African industries by dismantling tariff barriers. Anti-poverty campaigners argue that the EU is bullying poor countries to prematurely expose their economies to competition. The EU says that the current preferential regime agreed in 2000 has been ruled illegal by the World Trade Organization. Whoa, if the World Trade Organization says it, says, you know, you got to kill off your domestic economy, you got to kill off your middle class. After all, it's the best thing for the transnational corporations. Then that's what we've got to do, right? 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jackie in Seattle. Hey, Jackie, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Nice to talk to you. I'm going regarding the gentleman you talked to earlier, and I wanted to tell you that I agree with you wholeheartedly on the middle class and the destruction of it. You know, I was laid off a number of years ago. It took a while to get a job, and hey, I'm working, but I am making much less than half of what I was making before.
Yeah, I am seeing
this.
So
as far as employment and unemployment, I don't even pay attention to those numbers.
Yeah, I'm seeing this with so many of my friends who are, you know, particularly people in, as they get into their 40s and 50s, and their health insurance costs go up and their pay is actually going up. All of a sudden, they're the ones who get chopped and replaced by people in the 20s and 30s, no offense, who are working without health insurance and aren't quite as concerned about it because they're not quite, you know, that much older. And without all the retirement benefits and things. And it's like there's this evisceration of the American middle class.
It is. It truly is. You know, I mean, I do have health care and I do have retirement benefits, but comparatively, I was making a six-figure salary. Now I'm barely making, you know, $40,000,
$50,000. Yeah. Jackie,
and,
thanks.
You know, it's destruction.
Yeah, it really is. Jackie, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Ruth in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Ruth.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I was so upset with that man named Dan. I almost climbed through my radio. That man must live on a mountain someplace and hasn't got a clue to what's going on. I'm a 61-year-old woman. I think I have a better idea how women feel about being forced to work, dropping their children off at a daycare center, than he will ever find out. I don't know how you deal with these people, because not a word that he said had any truth or fact to it at all. He has no clue what's going on.
Well, no, actually, his statistics were accurate. People who make their money on investments, you know, like George Bush, I mean, he was born with investments. People who make their money on dividends and interest, they're doing better than they've ever done. They pay a maximum 15% income tax. They pay no Social Security taxes whatsoever. They're taxed at you know, less than half the rate that working people like you and I are. And the economy, that part of the economy, the investment part of the economy, is actually growing. It's what's not growing are the wages of working people.
Exactly. I make $11.50 an hour. I was out of work for 2 years trying to find a job. I found a job. I have no hot water. I have no heat. And all I can afford is a car payment, my insurance payment, and my food. I live at my son's house, and I don't even pay rent. This guy, I would just like to meet him in an alley and beat him to a pulp with my purse.
Okay, Ruth. Sentiments registered. Thank you very much. Mary Lou in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mary Lou.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Your two previous callers, they sort of said it all. However, all I have to say to that young man is shame on him for trying to sell a bucket of goods that is not real. He talked about the 70s. And how women wanted to work. No, women wanted the same pay for the same job that a man was doing.
Right. If they chose to go into the workplace. Right. And the same with men, for that matter. I mean, men would like to have a decent wage if they choose to go into the workplace.
Exactly. And shame on him. This man needs to get a new life.
Okay.
Or he needs to come out and live a real person's life.
Okay,
and
Mary.
Not live by statistics.
Mary Lou, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Beth in San Diego, California. Hey, Beth.
Hi, Tom. I was really disappointed when I heard you say that you believe most women go back to work simply as a means to supplement their income.
No, I didn't say that. What I said was that in the 1970s, 38% of women with children were in the workforce. Today, 70% of women with children are in the workforce. And there is no doubt in my mind that a significant percentage of those women are not in the workforce because they want to be. They're in the workforce because they have to be.
So all these women who go on and get higher degrees, who become scientists and engineers,
God bless
and writers.
Them. God bless them. I have two daughters who are, one is working on medical school, the other, yeah, God bless them.
They're just doing it as a way to make money, that's it. Not because it helps define their character, who they
no,
are.
No, if a woman wants to be in the workplace or if a man wants to be in the workplace, I think that's marvelous. And I think that there are a lot of people who, as families, couples who are married and have children make the decision that one of them will stay home with the kids. Now, in the years that Louise and I have been married 35 years, we've got three kids. They're all adults now. And I have stayed home more than a year with my kids while she worked. When she was the CEO of an ad agency, she has stayed home while I worked, and we've both worked. We've been through all of it. And I just think that with 70% of, and this was, it actually wasn't my point, it was Robert Reich's point. He said, as the middle class got chopped, as the ability of middle class people to earn an income was chopped, the first way that people tried to make that up was by becoming two income families. And when that wasn't enough, then they moved into turning their homes into ATMs, and now they're being wiped out. That was the point. Please, Dan Gaynor tried to characterize me as some kind of sexist in this thing. That's not the point at all. It's absolutely not the point at all. Bruce in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you, Beth. Bruce in Brooklyn, New York. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. What's up?
I just wanted to make a comment and affirm, what some of the things that you're saying about outsourcing and to just give people an idea, people, laymen like me, to tell them, take a minute when you go shopping and look at labels, see where clothes are made at. I went to a Old Navy store a couple of weeks ago looking for a scarf, and while I was in there, for some reason you popped up in my head, and I just decided to take a quick, survey of the labels. And I saw made in Bangladesh, made in China, made in Vietnam, made in Mexico, made in Korea. I didn't see one label that said made in the USA. And it is very, very, it confirmed what I've been hearing you say. And it's kind of scary.
Yeah, well, Bruce, it's because we have no manufacturing policy in the United States. We have had no manufacturing policy in the United States since the Reagan presidency, no meaningful manufacturing policy other than let transnational corporations go wherever they can find the cheapest labor and make the stuff there and then sell it back here. And the bill is coming due, by the way, because we've been borrowing money from these countries to buy their cheap stuff. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
9.5 minutes before the hour. 9:50 in the morning on the West Coast, 12:50 and noon 50 on the East Coast, and appropriate places in all places in between. Welcome back to our program, the Tom Hartman Program. 1-866-303-2270. All of this stuff, I would submit to you, brought to you courtesy of the transnational corporations of the world. John Edwards out there telling the truth about it in a new ad he's running in New Hampshire. I so wish I could hear other Democratic candidates. Dennis Kucinich talks like this, but that's about it. I would love to hear Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama say this kind of thing, or, you know, any of the Republican candidates other than Ron Paul.
The system is corrupt, and it's rigged, against you.
Finally, someone telling the truth.
And we can say, as long as we get Democrats in, everything's going to be okay. It's a lie. It is not the truth. Do you really believe if we replace a crowd of corporate Republicans with a crowd of corporate Democrats that anything meaningful is going to change? This has to stop. It's that simple.
That's John Edwards in his new campaign ad that's running in New Hampshire. Steve in New Jersey. Hey, Steve. Sorry, wrong side. Steve, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
I enjoy the program. I've been listening to you for a little while, and I've heard you speak about how the policies of Ronald Reagan and other Republicans, basically since the Carter administration, have decimated the economy and ruined the middle class. I admit I don't really know much about the history of our politics. I'm just getting into the workforce myself, and I was wondering if you could just expand on that a little bit.
Sure. What were the things that Reagan did? Number one, he dropped the progressive income tax, which acted as a cap on the accumulation of mind-boggling amounts of wealth among the top 0.1% of Americans. It used to be that if you made more than $3.2 million in today's dollars, that up until JFK, you paid a 91% income tax. Starting at that point, after $3.2 million. And JFK dropped it down to 71%, but closed up enough loopholes that it was solid. It was almost impossible to avoid. And Reagan collapsed that down to 27%. And so what that did was that began the shrinking of the middle class. Now, that so cut revenue to the government. He thought it was going to increase revenue to the government. So cut revenue to the government. He had to double the tax that is exclusively paid by working people, which is the Social Security tax. He doubled that. And that's the tax that was paid at that time on people only making up to $40,000. Right now, that tax is only paid by people making up to $97,000, I think it is. So, you know, after you make, if you make $1 million, $900,000 of that, you pay no Social Security tax on whatsoever. So Reagan doubled the tax on working people, cut by two-thirds, you know, dramatically, the tax on millionaires and billionaires, number one. Number two, he stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. He said, it doesn't matter if corporations get bigger and bigger and bigger. It used to be when Reagan came into office in the 70s, you know, he came into office in 81, but if you looked at America in the 1970s or before, every strip mall was full of locally owned businesses. Every, you know, stores, everywhere you went, you found locally owned businesses. People would start a dry cleaning shop and hand it down through generations of their family. We were a nation of small businesses. Now you walk into a shopping mall and you can't find one locally owned small business because Reagan, there was this thing called the mergers and acquisition mania of the 80s, the Michael Milken era, where all these guys got together and they with enormous amounts of debt, they would buy up companies, burden them with that debt, strip all the assets out of the company, offshore the jobs as much as they could. And this was a process that was actually started by Jack Welch when he was CEO of General Electric. He was the first guy to offshore jobs, back office jobs, accounting jobs to India. And then, you know, after that, in the 80s, they started offshoring jobs to China. This is all stuff that started under Reagan, picked up speed under Bush, really picked up speed under Bill Clinton. And Clinton really kicked the doors open when he signed NAFTA and GATT and the WTO was created and now is being continued by George Bush Sr. And the only winners in this are the transnational corporations and the very, very wealthy. And everybody else gets screwed. I mean, it's just the absolute bottom line is everybody else gets screwed. So thanks a lot for the call, Steve. Kat in Virginia. Hey, Kat, what's up?
Nothing much. I'm just driving to work. I wanted to call in and add my voice to the wonderful women who called earlier. I'm a prime example of what you're talking about. I have a doctorate. I went to graduate school. I teach at a university in Virginia, state-funded. And because of state budget cuts and because of all of the draining of our resources, I don't even make $50,000 a year. And with student loans and with my own household bills, I can barely make my mortgage.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the shrinking middle class, it's not just the attrition and the loss of our manufacturing jobs, but our jobs all across the board. I mean,
right.
It took me 5 years out of graduate school to find a tenure track permanent position. And when I did, it was at $41,000 to start.
Yeah, these guys are hell-bent for leather on destroying the middle class of the United States. Because the middle class, frankly, a strong, powerful, politically empowered middle class is a very troublesome thing. As we saw in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they tend to stand up and speak out. And the powers that be really didn't like that. Kat, thank you very much for your sharing your story. Bill in New York, we got about a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour. What's up, Bill?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to I know I have a minute, so I'm going to address a point you made earlier about what Robert Reich said. As early as 1994, then Secretary Reich had a speech addressed to the Democratic National Leadership Council. It was November 22nd, 1994, and he referred to the overclass and the anxious class.
Mm-hmm.
And I just brought this to everybody's attention because it's not really a party-based issue. It's more like what former Senator Edward says. It's class-based.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have Democrats who are part of the overclass and want to suck up to the overclass and take money from the overclass. And you've got a few Democrats who are speaking out on behalf of the anxious class. That would be John Edwards and Dennis Kucinich. And then on the Republican side, you've got all of the Republicans except for Ron Paul who are speaking out for the overclass. And arguably, Ron Paul's speaking out for the anxious class, except for the fact that he wants to do away with Social Security, national health care, and free public education. So I'm not sure he's speaking for the anxious class either. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Washington, D.C., the nation, the world is all abuzz right now about the CIA torture tapes. What was on them? Why were they destroyed? Who destroyed them? Who's covering whose butt? What's going on here? We talked with John Bolton about this last week, and he laid out, and I frankly didn't challenge him on this stuff. I didn't try to get into a fight with him on it because I really wanted to know his worldview rather than try to change his worldview. I knew that would be pretty useless. And he basically said there's been a coup. I mean, I used the word. I said, you know, it seems like there's been a coup inside the administration, inside the intelligence community, inside the State Department. And he was very willing to go along with that, not specifically use that word. But, yeah, that was, you know, he said there's people who have their own political agenda and are pursuing that at the expense of U.S. security and the administration's own agenda, presumably. Well, so I wanted to get our favorite spook on the radio here and find out what he thinks about it. Larry Johnson's a former Central Intelligence Agency officer, U.S. State Department officer in the Department of Counterterrorism, an expert in the fields of terrorism, aviation security crisis, and risk management. His blog is over at noquarterusa.net. And Larry, in fact, we had Larissa Alexandrovna on the program last Friday. You're the top of your blog. You're quoting some investigative research that she did. By the way, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, good to be with you, man.
Great to have you. Tell us what the latest news is on this stuff.
Well, the latest news is that the news media is not reporting the news.
That's not news, Larry.
Yeah, I know. I have a gift for the obvious.
Yeah, but we're reporting it here, so go for it.
What's not being reported is that the federal prosecutors, the U.S. attorneys in Richmond, actually viewed these tapes in September of this year. So although they were ostensibly destroyed in 2005, copies of them still exist and were being viewed as recently as a month ago. What remains to be asked is whether those tapes are still in existence.
Yeah, now this was the sole source of this, though, is a letter that two U.S. attorneys sent to the federal court on the 23rd of October.
Correct.
That letter may have misspoken. It might have been inaccurate. But if it is accurate, it means that not only is the administration been lying to us, which has become fairly obvious, but now they're lying to us about the lies that they're lying to us about.
Well, I'm not sure that the government, per se, at least the U.S. attorneys, are telling the judges, hey, we've got some tapes of these interrogations, and they don't appear to have anything to support the Mousavi case, but, you know, clearly they show some interrogations that and techniques employed in interrogations that would constitute torture. They don't say torture in the letter, but
right.
Clearly from what's contained in them, it sure leaves that impression with me. Now, one of the possibilities is that the individuals, Abu Zubaydah, for example, who was one of the individuals reportedly on the tape, was interrogated apparently in Thailand. So apparently Thai officials may have kept a copy and turned it over.
There's, right.
This story is just going to keep getting messier and messier because when these interrogations were first done and first recorded, that was back when Jim Pavitt was the director of operations at the CIA, and Kofor Black, who was Mitt Romney's counterterrorism advisor, was in charge of the counterterrorism center.
Mm-hmm.
So but the only one being fingered for this so far is a guy named Jose Rodriguez. So that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Now, one of the stories that's out there, and it's got a lot of traction, and it seems to be kind of parallel track to what Bolton was saying on this program last week, is that there was a group of senior intelligence officials, and apparently very senior, within the intelligence community, who basically said to the Bush administration, principally, I guess, to Dick Cheney, that they were willing to go to jail. They were willing to walk into the front door of the New York Times or NBC or CBS and say, I will disclose state secrets. I will go to prison for, you know, arguably treason. I will do that to tell the people what's really going on because you guys are covering it up. And their pressure, their willingness to put their lives in jeopardy and destroy their careers was so great that the Bush administration had to buckle and say, okay, we will let the truth be told. You're part of that culture. You came up in that culture. You know a lot of these people. Does that have credibility to you?
Yeah, no, it has a lot of credibility because I know that the National Intelligence Estimate was being held up. My understanding, and I've talked to one of the analysts who was actually involved with helping contribute to it, was that this thing was ready to go a year ago December. And that the
National Intelligence Estimate.
Yeah.
I understood it was ready to go before November, before the 2006 elections, and that they sat on the thing through the elections.
Yeah, that I don't know. My understanding was the time frame was more like December. But mm-hmm. in any event, the frustration was that the office of the vice president kept pushing back, and that, you know, they didn't like the conclusion. Now, what's so odd about this, and where John Bolton is just, you know, so completely full of crap, is that how is telling a fact a coup? How is providing information that is what you have without making a judgment? The CIA's judgment is not that, well, Iran stopped its nuclear program, therefore we shouldn't invade, or Iraq stopped its nuclear program, therefore we should have military strikes. They make no policy prescription. All they do is simply say, well, the intelligence we have now shows that Iran stopped its nuclear weapons program in 2003.
Right.
And, gee, why does that differ from what they said in 2005? Well, time didn't stop, and there were new sources of information.
Right.
I mean, how is it that these people can even be presumed to have intelligence and brains when they say stuff so patently stupid?
Yeah. Well, and that's the argument that the guys on the right are saying is, hey, wait a minute, the intelligence community is contradicting what it itself was saying 2 years ago. And what you're saying is, yeah, of course, you know, time goes on and you learn new things.
Well, if you get new information, you know, are they saying that regardless of whatever you learn, you're not supposed to change your opinion or offer a different judgment if you have new information? I mean,
yeah, that seems to be what the Hannitys of the world are saying. Yeah. We're talking with Larry Johnson, NoQuarterUSA.net, his blog, former CIA officer and State Department official. Larry, the bigger picture here to me seems to be that the intelligence community, to a large extent, many people within the intelligence community rolled over or at least kept their mouths shut in the face of the Bush administration lying about intelligence, as the Downing Street memo says, fixing the intelligence to conform with the policy, to the policy being that they wanted to invade. They wanted to have a war and an occupation of Iraq. And that this time around, the intelligence community, and arguably the military itself, I mean, here we had a few months ago the head of CENTCOM saying it's not a good thing to be talking about bombing Iran.
Correct.
That the military and the intelligence communities are now pushing back, that they're not going to at least take the fall for a second war in the Middle East. They may not be able to stop it, but they're not going to take the fall for it this time. Is that a reasonable analysis?
Yes. And what also has changed is that you have had a change in leadership where, unlike George Tenet, who was very political and willing to play ball from a political standpoint, much like a Hill staffer that he was, at least General Hayden, whatever faults and flaws he has not been willing to play the game as aggressively. And at the same time, there are senior intelligence officers, career professionals, who recognize that, you know, integrity is on the line, and they cannot afford to remain silent. You know, they can see what the consequences of it are, because if you go back to that October 2002 estimate, which is still an issue of some dispute, you know, note that even there, the intelligence community didn't say, oh, absolutely, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. And even on the issue of were they trying to reignite their nuclear weapons program, there was a dissent. There was difference of opinion within
right.
the intelligence community.
Right.
What's striking,
all the more reason to keep the inspectors in there.
Well, exactly. But what's striking about this latest national intelligence estimate is the fact that there is consensus among the intelligence agencies that contributed. So it's not just a CIA coup. It's a DIA coup. It's an INR coup. It's a Department of Energy coup. It's an NSA coup. So
it's
not
16
just
different
one
agencies.
Agency. It is.
Yeah.
There were really 8 different coordinating agencies on this. They talk about 16, 15 agencies, but when you get down to the actual writing of a national intelligence estimate and the analysts who are involved, it boils down closer to about 8.
We have just a minute left here. We're talking with Larry Johnson, NoQuarterUSA.net, his website. Larry, quick question. General Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA, came in after the waterboarding and torture had been done. Why would he be invested in covering up crimes that were committed before his participation in this part of the administration?
Well, that's why I don't think he's covering it up now, that they're the ones putting it out saying, hey, we have notified the prosecutors of this is what we have discovered.
Mm-hmm.
The other important part about this is it is clear that members of Congress were briefed on this, and they had the CIA had the approval of the White House and the Department of Justice. So, again, I think we need to avoid the impression of the CIA as some rogue elephant running around doing terrible things on its own.
Well, they were essentially doing what Alberto Gonzalez and Rami and Cheney had all said, this is fine.
Right, right. And it doesn't excuse it, but nonetheless needs to be put in its proper context that this is a broader problem than just one agency run amok.
Yeah, it's really an administration run amok.
Yes.
Larry Johnson, NoQuarterUSA.net. The website, check it out. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Happy holidays.
Thank you, and the same to you. Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And frankly, I think that that's what the Constitution says, is that it's a right. The right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life and happiness don't have to do with decent health care. I don't know what does. Welcome back to the program. Our question for this hour, particularly given the context of our conversation with Larry Johnson, what is the true nature of Americans? Are we really a bunch of terrified little people like Michael Wiener?
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill them.
Yeah, all those Muslims. It's just they're bloodthirsty. Kill them. And for that matter, George W. Bush speaking at the Republican National Convention.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists. Danger. Doom. Killers.
Now, this is all just out of one speech, Bush's keynote speech to the RNC.
God bless you. Evil God. Iraq.
Just a string in the order that they happened.
Be afraid.
We have fought the terrorists across
of his look out.
We are staying on the offensive, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back. And we will prevail. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat, and Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks. Free Afghanistan, terror. Pakistan, terrorists. Saudi Arabia, Libya, weapons programs. Saddam Hussein.
I mean, this, and it goes on and on. I'll stop it at that point. But the point is that when you look, when you do the polling, and this is what I find is actually quite interesting, the new McClatchy MSNBC poll found that in Iowa, for example, national security or terrorism is cited by only 1% of Democrats as the top thing on their list. It's in fact, it's last on the Democrats' list, whereas it's first on the Republicans' list, 31%. Republicans are terrified. In New Hampshire, it's the same thing, 25% of Republicans, yes, we're afraid of terrorism, only 2% of Democrats. In South Carolina, 25% of Republicans, only 6% of Democrats. On the other hand, in Iowa, 28% of Democrats are concerned about the economy, only 8% of Republicans. Bottom line here, when you look at these numbers that are coming out of these surveys, is you get it, that the Republicans are fearful because they're, in part, I'd say, because of the psychology of Republicans, by and large, but in larger part, because their leaders have been telling them to be afraid. And they listen to their leaders. The Republican leadership is all about selling fear. And Democrats are saying, no, I don't think that we're going to buy your fear, thank you very much. It's something that we would just rather not have.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Now, this was during the Depression.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
He was not speaking of World War II. That was Franklin Roosevelt, of course. He was speaking about the Republican Great Depression. So what is this fear thing? Back in 1972, Richard Nixon came back from a meeting with the Soviet Union with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and announced that he had initiated a process that they referred to as détente. On June 1st, 1972, Richard Nixon gave this speech. He said, and I quote, "Last Friday in Moscow, we witnessed the beginning of the end of that era which began in 1945. With this step, we have enhanced the security of both nations. We have begun to reduce the level of fear by reducing the causes of fear for our two peoples and all the people of the world." But then Nixon had to leave office in the midst of a scandal. Jerry Ford comes in, and Ford's Secretary of Defense, a guy by the name of Don Rumsfeld, and his chief of staff, a guy by the name of Dick Cheney, believed that it was intolerable that Americans could not be afraid. What? No longer bound by fear? Without fear, how can you manipulate people? And what about those billions of dollars that you can make off people's fear? They began a concerted effort, first secretly and then openly, during the Ford administration to undermine Nixon's treaty for peace and rebuild a permanent state of war in the United States. They did it by claiming that the Soviets had a new secret weapon, a weapon of mass destruction that even the president didn't know about, that the CIA didn't know about, that nobody knew about it except Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. They said it was a nuclear submarine technology that was undetectable by American technology. The CIA came out and said, this is a verbatim quote from the CIA, it's a complete fiction. And Rumsfeld says, see, told you the CIA can't find it. That proves how incredibly technologically advanced the Soviets are. Now, this is when the CIA was saying, no, the Soviet Union's falling apart. It's going to collapse in the next 15 years or so. And Rumsfeld and Cheney are like, no, you got to spend more money. You got to build a nuclear. And they created Team B, and the Committee for the Present Danger revived the latter to sell fear to the American people. They're still doing it.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour here on listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee at sacredgroundscoffee.com or Small Dog Electronics at smalldog.com or the Organic Wine Company at 1-888-ECO-WINE. And, of course, our local sponsors. Listen carefully for them. So the question, and our number 866-303-2270, the question, how do we change this fear meme in the United States? How do we take back America as the nation of people who are not terrified little men? We're the nation that stood up to the British in 1776. We're the nation that stood up to the British and the Canadians again in 1812. Even in the face of their coming over here and burning the White House down, we're the nation who stood up to them and said, no, we're going to fight back. We're the nation that survived a civil war. We're the nation that fought World War I and put Germany in its place. We're the nation that fought World War II and stopped the Nazis and the Italians and the Spanish. We're the nation that has continuously over the years gotten better and better and better at holding to the ideals that we originally spoke of all people being equal, of a government of, by, and for the people. How do we achieve that? How do we pull that back? We definitely don't do it with Rumsfeld and Cheney's Plan B, or Team B, excuse me, and their Committee on the Present Danger. I encourage you to just check out the Wikipedia entries for these things or Google them. I mean, it'll blow your mind. These guys, they were producing documentaries, publications, guests for national talk shows. Yeah, the Soviets, they've got this super secret weapon of mass destruction. Trillions of dollars were spent trying to deal with the threat of this super high-tech weapon of mass destruction. I frankly think the way we take this country back from those who are so terrified is by standing up and speaking out and saying, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. Even if one of these crazies from Saudi Arabia ends up over here blowing up another one of our cities, I'm not afraid. England dealt with it with the IRA. Israel dealt with it with the Palestinians. The Spanish dealt with it with ETA. And in each case, you know, you could say that the other side had some legitimate grievances. Nonetheless, you had countries that were saying, you know, we're not going to be afraid. We're not going to sacrifice human rights, civil rights. The Germans with the Bader-Meinhof gang, the Italians with, Aldo Moro getting killed by the Red Brigades, the former prime minister. Stuff him in a trunk and he suffocates, as I recall. I mean, talk about terrorism. And we just need to stand up and say, I'm sorry, I'm not afraid. Yeah, they can blow us up. They can set off a dirty nuke. Doesn't matter. I still won't be afraid. I'm an American. We're going to take this country back. We're going to do the right thing for us and for our people. And we're going to do the right thing by the world. And we're going to stand tall in this world. We are going to stand up straight in this world and say, we are not afraid. Verena in Seattle. Hey, Verena, what's up? Oh, sorry about that. There you go. Hey, Verena, what's up?
Good morning. I was wondering, at the risk of losing a lot of good friends, if I can say this, that I feel that religion and politics run by conservative people, and this is a very general statement, is closely related, and it's all fear-generated. And I'm a spiritual-minded person, but I have a lot of problems when I see the wrath of God constantly be put on people's heads.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Verena. It's where religion gets corrupted is where spirituality gets corrupted is when it becomes religion, when it becomes an institution, and those institutions then become run by people, and people start using fear and terror to maintain them. Yeah,
and isn't that the truth? What's happening in our capital and in countries where the Ayatollahs have a good time, and
it is, and then you end up with stuff like, you know, Michael Savage coming out and trashing the Muslims, you know, with
the bloodthirsty religionists practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill them.
Yeah,
total idiots. What can I say?
I mean,
I don't know. The only thing, like you said, we have to stand up to it. We constantly have to keep conquering it. because it has a fear base so ingrained.
Yeah. At a certain point, Verena, we just have to say, sorry, I'm not afraid. It's sort of like confronting death in a way, you know. It's a, having watched people die and having had some, you know, I have some sense of it, and I'm really not afraid of it. I'm afraid of the pain, or I'll cop to that. I'm afraid of the pain that might be associated with some ways of dying. But the experience of passing through and over and into whatever's out there, who knows, you know, maybe it's just all white light, or maybe it's being, you know, maybe the lights just go off. I can't say with certainty. I mean, I have my own opinions about it, but I'm not afraid of it. And I think that we all need to get to that point where we just say, you know, I'm not afraid. Jim in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. I was recently on a trip to California, and I had a chance to talk with an awful lot of people. And I'm very passionate about what's going on in this country and the fact that the biggest problem that we have is apathy. People are not informed of what's really going on, and that's because of our compliant, complicit corporate media. And until...
Well, it goes beyond that, Jim. It's our profitable corporate media, because the media makes money on people being afraid.
Well, that's true. I agree. But my point is that people are not even aware of what's going on, about the, you know, what Naomi Wolf says about how far down the road we are towards the 10 steps of, you know,
right,
a fascist society in this country, yeah, and how close we are to what's going on in Pakistan right now.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I like to test people on is... I can't tell you one of the judges on American Idol, but, you know, there's a survey out recently or a few months ago that said, you know, a far greater percentage of Americans can name you all three of those judges than can tell you any, let alone all five, of the rights guaranteed by the First Amendment.
Right.
And, you know,
or for that matter, could name the justices on the Supreme Court.
Or the justices on the Supreme Court. The point is that we have people who, and you've railed about this a great deal, and it's all connected, that we have infotainment out of our big corporations, that, you know, all five or six, you know, same conglomerates control every bit of flow of information except for what might be on the Internet, and they're working on trying to take that away, too. The bottom line is that, yes, we are afraid because they've worked concertedly at it, that the corporate media is very compliant and complicit in it. I mean, for example, why would CNN show this speech by Romney in prime time, but yet they don't show John Edwards railing against the corporate media?
Right, for the same reason that CNN was planning a two-hour special on the, mm-hmm, on the invasion of Iran, because it's profitable. It'll draw eyeballs, it'll draw advertisers, and that's what they're all about. And you said it very well. Thank you very much for the call. Jackie in Akron, Ohio. Hey, Jackie.
Hey, I think that the way that we can combat this fear factor that we all are supposed to live under is to just point out and make those that are such scaredy cats admit that the terrorists won on 9/12, because if this is a war on terror and everybody's terrorized, you know, they're all, you know, all the right wings and whoever,
yeah,
are just beside themselves under fear, which is plain to say that the terrorists won.
Yeah, or...
I'm so afraid of the corporate media, that's who I'm afraid of, and I'm afraid of our own... You know.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, maybe the real terrorists, I mean, obviously you've got the guys who flew the planes into the buildings, and I mean, you know, I think that they qualify as terrorists, but in terms of who's terrorizing the American people, I mean, Dick Cheney saying before the last election, if you vote for a Democrat, they'll hit us again.
Right.
That, in my mind, qualifies Dick Cheney as a terrorist.
Right. Our government is committing suicide on the people. We're all committing suicide. It's not from our...
Well, they're committing terrorism. Jackie, thank you very much for the call and for making the point. Danny in Los Angeles. Hey, Danny. No Danny. Okay. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Hi, Tom. A couple quick points. In terms of patriotism, you gave a very good presentation last week, and it's risking your life, your liberty, and your honor for your country.
Right.
I think we just had a demonstration of real patriotism with the people that risk that to get this NIE on Iran out, to get it,
yep,
out of the Cheney black hole.
Yep.
That means that patriots, real patriots, are still alive in the United States, and that they're not the cowards cowering in the White House or secret undisclosed locations. And I want to say one thing. I went through Vietnam, and the military oath and the intelligence oath is to support and defend the Constitution.
Right.
The Constitution, not the president.
Right, not the administration.
Not at all.
You know, not even the nation, but the Constitution.
The Constitution.
That is the fabric of the Constitution.
That's what we died for. Well, the thing is, civilian control of the military is by the voters.
Right.
That means the president and the secretary of defense are merely agents for 4 years or 8 years at most of we the people. Mm-hmm. That, what needs to be for civilian control is we the people get the truth.
Yes.
And I think when we get the truth, we aren't going to be made afraid by our coward-in-chief, Vice President Chicken.
There you go. Well said, Ralph. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. TomHartman.com, our blogs and message area. You can reach our live chat room there. Also the blog over there, America.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Clean air, blue sky, will they be here when I die? Tall trees, white snow, will they be here when I go?
Time to take a stand. 9 minutes before the hour, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com, their website, all kinds of cool stuff over there. Ellen, thanks for joining us. What's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, thank you. The White House attorneys have told Dana Perino not to answer specific questions dealing with the CIA tape issue. Dana Perino thinks it's appropriate and will adhere to it. So, therefore, that has effectively shut down anything we're going to be hearing from the White House about the CIA.
Now, this is Dana Perino, who recently said, once a Bushy, always a Bushy, and whose husband is Dan Senior, isn't he, the spokesman for the Pentagon?
No, actually, I don't think it is. I think that her husband is a man from London.
Right, I know he's British. Oh, that's
Dan,
not Dan
Senior is, I think, married to the former Campbell Brown.
Oh, that's right, Campbell Brown. That's Campbell Brown's husband. Yes, thank you. The news reporter. I'm mixing up my spouses here. You know who's with whom.
No, she married an older man from England, I believe.
Yeah, and Karl Rove was bemoaning that. That's where I got that story from.
But she also apparently was on Wait, Don't Tell Me. And you know what, I have to tell you, I happen to like Dana personally. I think she's a great human being personally. I don't agree with her politically. But she did admit on Wait, Don't Tell Me that she came back and asked her husband about the invasion of Cuba, the Bay of Pigs.
And the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was.
That's right, Cuban Missile Crisis, and she didn't really know about it.
Yeah, she needs to see that movie, 13 Days or 7 Days or whatever.
That's right.
The brilliant movie
about
the Cuban Missile Crisis, yeah.
Great movie. Okay, so we're not hearing anything on that. Also today, the Iraq foreign minister said that they are going to try and come to some agreement by July as to the limits on U.S. troops in Iraq.
Hmm.
Interesting. We'll see what happens on that one. I'm not holding my breath.
Who said that again?
The Iraq foreign minister. He is negotiating with the United States, and this hopefully will happen in July.
So is Iraq talking about imposing limits on American troops, or are they talking about asking? Because the official conservative position is, as soon as you name a date or a number, you've, for all practical purposes, lost the war. Because they're
Iraq is now saying that they are going to negotiate as a sovereign nation.
Right. In other words, Iraq is viewing it as an occupation, and they're saying, we've got to work the occupiers out of our country. The U.S. is viewing it as a war, at least this administration, and the complicit, their handmaidens in the press. I just couldn't believe this weekend, Tim Russert, you know, asking Rudy Giuliani about this, and Giuliani going on and on and on about how we can't lose the war, and I was yelling at the TV, it's not a war, you idiot, it's an occupation! But in any case, the administration is going on about it being a war, but apparently the Iraqis are viewing it as an occupation.
Apparently, well, actually, if you get the polling of Iraq, it certainly showed that it's they view it as an occupation. Guder Libby has decided not to appeal. Now, it's interesting as to why he's dropped his appeal. If he went through the appellate process and got a second trial, there's a possibility that, of course, Bush would not be president by the time the second trial happened, and therefore commuting Libby's sentence would not work because he might not be president. So Libby decided, obviously, for costs, because he may not like the president that's in there, et cetera, that he is going to drop his appeal.
Which means that on the QT, he's been told that on his way out the door, Bush is going to pardon him.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I think.
I think this is a pretty clear indication of it. And also, the other thing is, if there was an appeal, then you might have somebody on the other side saying, okay, we're going to subpoena some witnesses here, and we'd like Mr. Cheney and Mr. Bush to come speak on the stand, or their representatives or whatever. You know, it just could become very uncomfortable for the administration.
Exactly. Exactly. A couple other interesting things. 7-2 decision at the Supreme Court that allows judges to decide to reduce sentences in crack cocaine sentences, because that would then reduce the disparity that now exists between cocaine and crack cocaine.
Yeah, good. Good.
Okay.
This is basically a racial war that has been fought by the criminal justice
racial
system.
War, because crack cocaine is more in the sort of ghettoized areas, et cetera, and cocaine is more an upper class drug.
Yeah.
9-0 to increase in prison time. There's a question. You can increase prison time if a firearm is used in commission of a law. However, they are now saying that if the gun was used as part of a barter deal in the crime, then you do not have to increase it.
Hmm.
So that if you use a gun in commission of crime, it automatically increases the sentence. However, if it's used as a barter, in other words, I'll give you this gun if you sell me this drug and then there was a robbery or something, there's a barter, that does not increase the time.
Yeah, interesting.
Also, a case by public citizen. There were two forms of a bill that were passed. They did not agree with each other, one by the House, one by the Senate. The House and Senate say that it was a clerical error there. And so now public citizen lost the case. Supreme Court said the law is still the law.
That's surprising. The Supreme Court would say such a thing?
Even
given its current
makeup.
Even
though there was a disparity in the House and Senate part of the law when it was passed.
Interesting. Interesting.
Now, one last thing. As you know, I also cover the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And there was a situation where the Secretary General has appealed to every single country, including the United States, for helicopters in the Sudan, Darfur area.
Right.
The United States and no other countries has given it. The United States is saying they have not gotten such a request. The Secretary General says that they have spoken to every country. That's new meaning to the term black helicopters.
I guess that's, yeah, they don't exist. No droids in this car. Thank you, Ellen Ratner. Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program, for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Welcome back. You know, the Constitution, as in, you know, the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution says that if Congress ratifies a treaty with another country or another entity, in this case the United Nations, collection of countries, that treaty becomes part of the law of the land. Now, this is kind of a two-edged sword, and it's one of the things conservatives have been quite hysterical about for a lot of years, about, oh, my God, the U.N., we're signing these treaties, that means the law of the land is the U.N. law, you know, quack, 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 one world government, oh, no. Although they don't seem to have a problem with us signing trade treaties that do the same thing, creating the World Trade Organization, another world, one world government. But anyhow, the bottom line is that if we sign a treaty, that becomes the law of the land. And it trumps any laws, it becomes the federal law of the land, so it trumps any laws that might disagree with it. And we signed a treaty, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, ICERD. We signed this thing back in 1969. And it requires us to fix racism in the United States. Ajamu Baraka is with us. He is the executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Ajamu, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly, sir?
Perfectly.
Great. Thank you. Tell us, what's the state of the United States' compliance with this treaty that we signed in 69?
Well, let's first make sure we are completely accurate with the historical record. True, it was signed in 1969, but unfortunately it wasn't ratified by the Senate until 1994.
Oh, my. I stand corrected. Thank you.
Yes, and at that point, when it was ratified, it meant that the U.S. government was committing itself to eliminating racial discrimination in all its forms within the country. It also meant that it had to submit to the treaty monitoring body a periodic report every 2 years, mm-hmm. a report that would reflect its compliance with the terms of the treaty. Well, that didn't really happen on time. There was a report that was submitted in 2000, and then the second report was submitted just this year to the CERB committee. In that report, it was 112 pages, a story was constructed by the government, a story that didn't seem to correspond to anyone's understanding of the reality of what's happening in this country concerning race, that is anyone who's really serious about looking at reality. It was what we consider to be a complete whitewash. It did not address the continuing problems with police brutality in various parts of the country. It did not deal with the ICE raids that are being conducted across the country and terrorizing Latino communities and the racial profiling that's impacting both undocumented and documented workers and immigrants around the country. It did not deal with the environmental issues that are still impacting minority communities. It only dealt with Katrina with less than a paragraph. So basically, it was almost sort of a fantasy paper that was submitted to the UN monitoring body.
This is incredible. We're talking with Ajamu Baraka. He's the executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Their website, by the way, USHR, as in U.S. Human Rights Network, network.org. So, Ajamu, two things immediately come to mind as a consequence of this. The first is, you know, we're not in compliance with these things. The second is that one of the reasons, it seems to me anyway, that we're not in compliance is because there has been a 400-year history of racism in the United States. It's grounded in our DNA and all those things that really needs to be rooted out and cleaned up. But on top of that, we've had a 30-year war against the middle class in the United States, and arguably people on the bottom end of the socioeconomic ladder have been hit even harder than those in the middle. And the consequence of that is that you see all this scapegoating, you know, oh, it must be those brown people coming in from Mexico, or oh, it must be those, you know, Reagan with his welfare queen rhetoric, which he made up out of thin air, and, you know, appealing to racist sentiments, the Republican Southern strategy that, you know, as recently as the last election was played out in the election in Tennessee with the ads against Harold Ford with the woman going, hey, Harold, call me. You know, I mean, this stuff is part and parcel of the Republican Party, and frankly, even a few Democrats out there. This goes beyond just, you know, what we're doing with the UN, does it not?
It really goes to the core of national identity here in this country, and you sort of alluded to that. And it's unfortunate because at one point, I think we were making significant progress in terms of trying to come to terms with our own history. As you indicated, the issue of race has been used as a political football, and political parties have used this as a wedge issue. They have used it to confuse people and to pit various groups against each other. And the consequence has been that there has been a sort of a poverty of discourse on the issue of race.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one of the things that the government committed itself to when it ratified the convention was to promote an understanding among all races. That's a very key principle.
Right.
In the report, they claim that they have done that, and the evidence that they point to show that there's a promotion of a better understanding among the races is the movie Crash.
What?
Yes.
Yeah, I've not seen the movie. I'm sorry.
Well,
I don't get it. You mean they're saying because some studio made a movie that we're promoting reconciliation between the races?
That's the claim that they're making. I mean,
that's nuts.
I think that the producers would be surprised to know that they had the backing of the Bush administration with that movie.
Yeah.
But that's just sort of a funny but yet tragic sort of example of the nature of the report and the kinds of cherry picking that they engaged in this report.
I remember back when I was a kid, as a young teenager in the early 60s, that in our schools, as a consequence of some of the things that John Kennedy and then Lyndon Johnson were promoting. I mean, LBJ cut poverty by 40% during his presidency in the United States among families. That in our public school curriculum, there was curriculum about the history of racism in the United States, the history of slavery in the United States. I attended a school that was mostly white, and it was trying to sensitize white kids to what it's like to be African American in the United States. My recollection is, and I wasn't in school when Reagan came along as president, although we had kids in school at that time, that most of that stuff went by the wayside over the last 30 years. Are there still programs like that in our public schools? Are we still trying to teach our kids about, that aspect of the history of the United States and how it's still very alive and well today?
I would argue that there are some programs that still exist, but if you might recall that many of those kinds of courses were sort of connected or collapsed into some of our civic courses. But civic courses have been almost completely eliminated throughout the entire country.
Right.
It's all, again, connected to this whole assault on the intellectual basis of this country. That is, the right wing being so concerned about the proliferation of so-called liberal ideals, they have completely eliminated any discussions around values within the school system. So basically, those kinds of discussions that we used to be able to have a few decades ago are completely absent now today.
Yeah, this is the war that David Horowitz is still fighting in our universities that really started during the Reagan administration in our high schools when the right-wingers were on TVs going, oh, we've got these unionized teachers, they're communists, they're socialists, and they're teaching our kids about the history of labor and wobblies, and oh, we can't have that, it's communist. And there was the Great Purge.
It definitely was, and what we have now in place is a few generations of folks who don't have a real grounding in the complexities of American history and the evolution of this society. And so they are open, when you talk about things like race neutral policies and laws, it makes sense, it sounds fair, but it's decontextualized. If you look at the fact that they use race neutral policies in a racist way to have disparate impact.
Right. Then they become essentially, they amplify the racism of the system that they're operating in.
Exactly.
Simply because they're race neutral. Exactly. Jaume Baraka, he is the executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network today, it's the International Human Rights Day, USHRnetwork.org. Jaume, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Minutes past the hour. There's a somewhat scary trend that I'm seeing out here. that I see Mike Huckabee as the cheerleader for, although Mitt Romney is right out in front of it as well. The Arkansas Democrat Gazette, Arkansas's largest newspaper, ran an article, was this today or yesterday? I don't see a date on the online version. That by Linda Kalquet, or Kalouette. It said, government may have dropped the ball in modern American society, but religion dropped it first, Governor Mike Huckabee told Southern Baptist pastors Sunday night. The reason we have so much government is because we have so much broken humanity, he said. And the reason we have so much broken humanity is because sin reigns in the hearts and lives of human beings instead of the Savior. Now, I have said many times in this program that the primary thing that separates liberals from conservatives is that conservatives believe that people are fundamentally evil, and therefore we need to find the few good ones among us and give them enormous amounts of power and wealth and let them rule over us, because we can trust the few good ones. It used to be the few good ones who were ordained by God, whether they were popes or whether they were kings or queens. To this day, the currency in England has a series of letters on it that stand for the Latin that the queen reigns by the grace of God, by the ordination of God. And whereas liberals would say, no, sorry, liberals like Thomas Jefferson, like James Madison, like Ben Franklin, like George Washington. No, sorry, we don't believe that people are essentially evil. We acknowledge that there are some evil people among us. But the vast majority of people, no, are not evil. The vast majority of people are fundamentally good. And that's why you want to distribute the power downward to as many people as possible. Which is why liberals are constantly saying, let's have as many people as possible vote and participate in government. And conservatives are always saying, let's have as few people as possible vote in government. Because there's this fundamental difference about whether people are fundamentally good or evil. Huckabee goes on to say in this article, government knows it does not have the answer, but it's arrogant and acts though it does. Church does have the answer, but it will cowardly deny that it does and wonder when the world will be changed. I'm sorry, it's not about religion, Mike Huckabee, or Reverend Huckabee is how I suppose how he should be referred to. It's about economics. You want to know why you've got crime? Economics. You know, there was a time in the United States when serious scientific papers were being published in the late 1800s. Serious scientific papers. Well, this was actually more like the 1870s, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. About why, you know, trying to answer the question about why the Irish were genetically predisposed to being criminals. After all, the British had been deporting them to Australia for 30 years. The millions of them who showed up in the U.S., were far more likely to be arrested for crime in Boston and many of the communities where they first showed up. Why are the Irish such criminals? Never thinking for a moment that maybe it was because they were being discriminated against as new and recent immigrants who were a little different in the way they talked. And therefore vulnerable to discrimination. And then later when the Italians were coming in large, there must be some genetic basis for the mafia. Why are the Italians all criminals? I mean, we've seen this over and over and over again, and it always boils down to this simple thing. It's economics. It's not religion. And this is, you know, actually somebody should ask Mitt Romney this question. I mean, his religion teaches, the Book of Mormon teaches, that before creation, there were some people who turned their back on God in heaven. And so when they got incarnated on earth, they got black skin. And right up until 1978, they could not participate in the Mormon church. Which is, I mean, this is original sin carried to its extremes. But again, Romney and Huckabee are saying the solution is religion. He says, Huckabee says, I'm often asked why taxes are so high and government so big. It's because the faith we have in local churches has become so small. If we've been doing what we should have, give a dime from every dollar to help the widows, the orphans, and the poor, we wouldn't now be giving nearly 50 cents of every dollar to the government. Sorry, Mike, wrong. We should give our money to religious kingdoms, because religious institutions, churches, by and large, are not run as democratic institutions. I mean, for example, here's this story in ABC News. A Florida megachurch has garnered national attention with its annual Christmas pageant. Extensive pyrotechnics, livestock, a bevy of actors. It's 600 actors. The play rivals some Las Vegas-style productions, and Broadway producers choreographed the show. 600 actors. This thing costs $1.3 million to put on. So if we give our money to the megachurches, are they solving the problem of poverty in the communities where they exist? No, they're putting on $1 million Christmas pageants. But Huckabee says, no, no, we should do away with federal welfare programs and just give our money to more of the churches. As a Christian, I'm offended. As a citizen of the United States, I'm horrified. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Welcome back. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Okay, there must be some dogs out there voting. That's the only thing I can come up with. Or maybe there's some consentage. Obviously, I'm being facetious here. The KPOJ straw poll, the radio station that from which, you know, the home station for this show, AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, has been running the straw poll, and my Cat Higgins beat every Republican, all of the independents, and all of the Democrats except Dennis Kucinich. And now we're down to the final round, and it's my Cat Higgins against Dennis Kucinich. And right now, Higgins has only 21% of the vote. Which ain't bad. I mean, you know, there's been thousands of votes cast. But Dennis Kucinich is beating my cat. I don't know. I'm going to have to go home and this afternoon have a conversation with Higgins about his campaign strategy. We'll see. Maybe he can come up with something new. I don't know. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Paula in Seattle, you want to set me straight on the Mormon faith. Hey, Paula.
Hi, Tom Hartman. I love your show. I think you're great, and I know that you always want to give facts. So I am a Mormon, and I was a missionary for 18 months in Germany, so I know what it is we believe. And we don't believe that blacks turned away from God before they were born, and that's why they're skin is
black. Does it not
black.
Say that in the Book of Mormon?
No, that is not taught in the Book of Mormon. Not at all.
Was that not the official church doctrine until 1978?
No, not at all. The official church doctrine is that when Cain killed Abel back in the beginning, the two sons of Adam.
Right.
Cain was cast out from Adam and his descendants.
He bore the mark, and the mark was blackness.
And the reason for that was to keep the non-believers and the believers separate so that non-believers, so that they wouldn't sort of intermarry and teach their kids false doctrine.
Right, but the reality is that the church up until 1978 didn't allow African Americans or people of color to be members because they were bore the mark of Cain.
They were allowed to be members, but the men were not allowed to hold the priesthood until 1978.
Right. And the priesthood is something that the head of every Mormon family holds, is it not?
Every worthy Mormon man can hold the priesthood who's keeping the commandments.
Now, I suppose we should put this in context. You know, the Catholics were executing people. The Catholics ran the Crusades. You had Protestant pilgrims who were in the United States burning women at the stake in Massachusetts and hanging witches.
Right.
You know, there's no shortage of religious horrors. You go back, a couple thousand years in the book of Jeremiah, and you had Jewish tribes who were told by God to go to the city of Ai and kill every living thing, including cutting open the bellies of pregnant women. It's not like there's no shortage of god-awful things that have come along with various religions over the years. It just seems that Mormonism's a little more recent. Do you know if Mitt Romney has disavowed the official position of his church pre-1978? Because he certainly was a member of it prior to that time.
If he has disavowed the position of the church before
the position of the church with regard to African Americans, yeah.
I can't say that. Anyone who is an active member of the church believes all of the church doctrine, and we can't really explain why blacks weren't given the priesthood before 1978. We know that God kind of has a bigger perspective than we do as people, and so that maybe if they had been given the priesthood, the society at that time wouldn't accept, that blacks were, because there's slavery. I mean, there was slavery, there was racial injustice and everything. And
yeah. Sounds like rationalization, Paula. But at least they got with the program. Let's just leave it at that and give Mormons the credit for, as of 1970, a lot of people still have not gotten with the program. There's still a lot of racism out there. Paula, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Caller in Savannah here. I'm sorry, my call screen software just went nuts and I can't see your name, but you can hear that you're on the air, I think.
Yes, my name is Peter Berquist, calling from Savannah about International Human Rights Day.
Yeah.
And I wanted to also thank you for your great show. And what it means to me, part of what it means to me is that it's part of the declaration is that everyone has the right to form and join trade unions for the protection of his interests.
Yes.
And that's something we need to promote. And we are having a rally today in Savannah.
Savannah, Georgia?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
In honor of International Human Rights Day, we are having a rally outside Paula Deen's restaurant in as a result of her support of being a paid spokesperson for Smithfield Foods. I don't know if you're familiar with this campaign.
Smithfield Foods was union. Is this the company that was engaged in union busting?
Yes, correct.
Okay, yeah, I'm somewhat. I've read about it. I can't claim intimate familiarity with it.
Right. Just real quickly, among other things, they were convicted by the NLRB of assaulting workers during the last union election,
mm-hmm.
using all sorts of illegal intimidation tactics, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the call and for the heads up. Much appreciated. Tim in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tom. I was just calling in regard to the Mormon 1978 allowing African Americans into the higher-ups of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in Utah at the time, and what was going on is that there was a African-American young man trying to get into Eagle Scouts, and he couldn't. And there was a lawsuit with, I don't remember if it was the federal courts or state courts, but that's when African-Americans were allowed to get into the higher-ups in the Mormon church.
Well, whatever it takes. I'm not a Mormon. I don't know that much about Mormonism. I did, I used to stay in Marriott's a lot. I still do, actually. And there was always a Book of Mormon in the Marriott Hotel, and I've actually probably read, I don't know, 40, 50 pages anyway of the Book of Mormon, just out of curiosity, laying in bed at night trying to get to sleep. And it just never clicked for me, never made a whole lot of sense to me, but, at least, the religion has acknowledged the racism of their past and corrected it. I think we have to give them some credit for that.
And I do. And there's a lot of good things, but there's some very bizarre things also.
Yeah, but find me a religion that you can't say that of.
That's true.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Tim. I appreciate it. This is the continual battle, I think, for all people of faith is that distinction between spirituality and religion. Will in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Will, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Doctor. You're the man. What do you think is going to happen with the Republican regime? Is there a chance it can be changed in the next election?
I sure hope so. My biggest concern is that we're going to end up with Republican light in the Democratic side. But I my hope is that the Democratic candidates right across the board are going to start adopting more progressive points of view. And frankly, I think if they do, that they'll win because America is a very progressive country. When you do surveys and you ask people about the actual issues, America is an incredibly progressive country and has been for the better part of well, easily 100 years, and I would argue more than 200 years. And so we'll see. We'll see. Time will tell. In fact, we'll be doing our show live from New Hampshire, the 2 days, Monday and Tuesday of the primaries. So it's the second week of January, I guess it is. John in New York City. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great.
Been listening to you for a while. I love your show.
Thank you.
You, of course, you nailed everything that I was saying when you, your previous guest was talking about race relations and all the legislation and all of this stuff. This country, I'm a patriot. I'm an African-American, but I consider myself a patriot. When I was taught in school, like you say, civil, you know, taught about this country's history, I looked up to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and all these other cats because I believe in the ideals of every man getting what they want in the history of John Locke, Voltaire, Rousseau, you know, all the cats that laid it down in the Enlightenment, all of the foundations of every man has a right to everything.
Right.
You know, this country is like it's not done yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's
well said. Well said.
It's in the oven, and it needs to be cooked a little longer and before you can criticize other people, especially other chefs.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure it's done. So we have a ways to go. But the Constitution, it's all there. The document is sound.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, John. And that's why we need to stand up and defend it and speak out against those people who are attacking it, like this current administration.
I know.
John, got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. It's much appreciated. Karen in Los Angeles, we've got just a minute before a break. Karen, what's up?
Oh, I just want to say that the last guest, his efforts should be applauded, are very commendable. But this idea that all we have to do is talk about race and that, you know, the things are going to be smoothed out and the rough patches are going to be smoothed over, I think is highly unrealistic when you look at the fact
that... Well, Jama wasn't talking about just talking about it. He was calling on us to comply with the law.
But it's taken black people 40 or 50 years to kind of claw our way into the middle class. And a lot of that was due to having a little bit of political muscle.
Yep.
And in the last two decades, we've watched that erode because of the huge demographic shifts in the United States, and I think you're going to have to really address how immigration has affected the black middle class specifically in this country before we can actually get to the point of a dialogue where we can kind of understand each other.
I absolutely agree with you, Karen, and to the extent that immigration, and I would say frankly that outsourcing is a larger piece of it, but to the extent that illegal immigration is hurting the middle class, it's hurting the African-American middle class the worst. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. And we'll hopefully be lifting some folks up here on Friday night, 7 o'clock, University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Looking forward to an opportunity to fly through the Larry Craig Memorial Airport there. It should be great fun. Well, they haven't renamed the airport yet? Oh, well, anyhow. And we get to see the Ronald Reagan Memorial Collapse Bridge. Oh, they haven't renamed the bridge? Well, anyway, welcome back to the program. I'm actually looking forward to going. I love the Mid. You know, I grew up in Lansing, Michigan. I mean, the Midwest is my home, and great to be going back there this week. In fact, after I'm doing the radio show on Friday from our affiliate Minneapolis, Air America Radio or Radio Air America, Minneapolis Air, Minnesota Air America Minnesota, I think is what they call. And then we'll be traveling over to Lansing to spend the weekend with my family, visit my mom and my three brothers and their families and all that kind of stuff. George in Denver, Colorado. Hey, George, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Just fine.
Sorry to ask the redundant question. You just slipped. I've been enjoying bits and pieces of your show on your focus on race, which I can't resist because of my passion. In fact, I've had some irreconcilable discussions with many talk show hosts on that very topic. I just wanted to throw in that I really do think that the racial equation is very significant, is a very significant challenge to our nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we really need to have a frank, candid, open discussion about it. If we are to dig our way out of this mess that the Bush administration, that the global conquest, the global quest has, where it has brought us, it just simply has to be done. And it's a complicated question. And, we need to be willing to look at, various angles, various aspects of it. Basically, we just need to be open and willing to discuss it.
Yeah. And George, we were having that discussion back in the United States during the era of Martin Luther King, and it was a very productive one and a very useful one. It was being held by adults, by school children, by, you know, right across the board. And now what we have, once again, is the politics of racism. As I mentioned, you know, Harold Ford, the ad against Harold Ford Jr. in Tennessee, where the white woman says, come on, Harold, call me. And, you know, Harold Ford Jr. had been way ahead in the polls, and boom. Now, some people say he lost because of his policies, because he was a DLC Democrat. He was a Republican light. Probably. That, you know, I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. But, you know, we discount racism in this country. In all cases, we discount racism at our own peril. It is alive and well, and anybody who claims that it is, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Harvard University has this test. You can take it online to measure your preference, unconscious preference, not conscious. And it's a timed test where they flash words, positive or negative words, and they flash faces, African American or white faces. And they've also got one for tall people and for fat people, and you know they've got a bunch of different ones. And I took the test, and I came out with a light preference for white people. And you know, surprise, surprise, all of us, I think, at some level, racism is just built into us. And if we're going to fix it, we have to acknowledge it and move forward. Cornelius in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Cornelius.
Great show, Tom. I've got a quick comment. I'm very familiar with Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. I would challenge anyone to find whites in the first 5 books of Moses and even further. They do not exist yet. They hadn't come to be yet. So that is my comment. Wonderful show. I look forward to listening to you just as much as I can. So you have a great week. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Cornelius. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point. The New Testament was arguably brown people, light brown people, and the Old Testament probably darker brown people. I mean, you travel around Egypt, particularly southern Egypt. You travel around the Middle East, you don't see, quote, you know, Aryan types. So it's, yeah, good point. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, well, speaking of racism, I believe the Mumia Abu-Jamal case is a perfect example of it. You got this Bill O'Reilly wannabe, Michael Smirkonish. He's putting out a smear job against the Mumia Abu-Jamal. You got these right-wing idiots like Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly going after these celebrities like Mike Farrell, Ed Asner for supporting Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'll mention something you probably never heard before, nobody in your audience ever heard before. Frank Serpico, the most famous and incorruptible cop that ever lived, actually thinks that Mumia Abu-Jamal is innocent. Mm. You will never hear this in the media. Yeah. You will never hear anybody bringing this type of subject up.
Yeah, no. Well, not just Mumia. You don't hear a conversation right now, you know, outside of the occasional mention on probably either liberal talk radio or public radio about how the governor of Illinois stopped all death row executions because there was such endemic racism built into the system and so many innocent people were being executed. I mean, it's just it's right across the board. You hear very little conversation about any of it, but spot on, Joe, and well said. Jonathan in Florida. Hey, Jonathan.
How you doing, Tom? First off, I want to say it's an absolute honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
Okay. And it's also nice to know I'm not the only one who yells at the TV set.
Welcome to the club.
I actually picked that up from my father. He was very bad at that. Anyway, I've been hanging on for quite a while. I'm really going to harken back to something you said before about people not standing up and hollering, you know, saying they're not want to take it anymore.
Or saying that they're not afraid anymore.
Right, they're not afraid anymore. Well, you see, the Republican Party realized the strength of the Lincoln reference of the House divided against itself and turned it on its head.
You're right.
With people in this country under assault just by living right now, it's impossible. We feel so isolated. It's hard to find strength to be able to say that. I've talked about this a lot on my radio show down here.
Now, Jonathan, you are absolutely right, and I appreciate the con. You are absolutely right. We need to stand up and say, I am not afraid. Coming up tomorrow, Troy Dunn has a book, Young Bucks, How to Raise a Millionaire. Say what? John West is here. Darwin Day on America, How Our Politics and Culture Have Been Dehumanized in the Name of Science? What? Anthony Romero dropping by to urge senators to say no to a bill that aims to grant immunity to telecom companies. That's the ACLU, the head of the ACLU, plus the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.